Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 5:19 p.m. That is Central Time. Today is Friday, and it's January 13th. It's also the big picture, long term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I had been hoping to record this broadcast when I was in Frankfurt, but the amount of time I had to spend queuing at the flight transfers was kind of profound, and it just wasn't possible. But after spending a few days in Saudi Arabia this week, and I've really been ruminating on the way home about demographics. So we know that China has the largest population, but probably not for much longer. And India is quite likely to exceed it in the not so distant future. And we also know that China's population is aging rather quickly because there isn't a swell of new babies that have been born over the last 30 years. So, as the big bulge of the population progressively ages, then the aggregate age of the population is going to age a bit faster than just about everywhere else. Well, India's birth rate hasn't quite peaked yet, but it's probably close to peaking, and that's going to take the population up. And it could quite easily already be higher than China's because this population data on the third column from the right here is from 2017. And we already know that Egypt's population was 96 million in 2017, and in the space of 5 years has risen to 105 million. So it's not like the pace of births is rolling over. Now, of course, this is going to raise important challenges, and it really is going to come down to governance. Because when you have strong economic, social governance, then the potential to harness the really profound productive capacity of hundreds of millions of young people is very promising, and it could lead to very strong economic growth. And by extension, with strong governance, it would translate into then strong stock market performance. Now, I know that economists are going to make an argument, and they're going to say there's no link between economic growth and stock markets. And that's not exactly true. So we know, for example, that India's stock market has done much better than China's. And then we can think about the trend of governance. Well, economic governance in China versus India is there's no parallel. We can see that on a per capita basis, that China basically has a higher GDP per capita, almost 4 times greater than that of India. So that tells us that China's economic management is better. But when it comes to the stock market and how investors are treated, then India is way ahead because it does have property rights. Now, that impedes a lot of the economic potential because bureaucracy gets in the way. But it does also mean that an investor who invests in India has a chance that when they do eventually wish to sell, that they might actually have an opportunity to do so at unfavorable terms. Now, it doesn't mean that corruption has been banned in India. And I think to even suggest it is to would be to display absolutely no knowledge of reality. So corruption is really something that is a major problem in every country, but it's the extent to which it infects capital markets and the freedom of doing business where it really stands to have a major impact. So then we can see that Indonesia, in terms of GDP per capita, is somewhere between India and China, but its population is about a fifth that of India. Pakistan is a market relatively similar in population to India, but without the commodity bonus. Then Brazil is a population of 207 million and has a higher GDP per capita than China. So, a more developed country overall, and therefore has a stronger need to deploy the kinds of policies and take the risk in terms of policy that can lift the economy out of the middle income trap. To escape the middle income trap is exceptionally difficult, and it requires a very clear willingness by those who are in power to embrace high standards of governance. And then let's think about Egypt. So the population has gone up by not much less than 10% in the last 5 years. And it's a country where 95% of the population lives within about 2 miles of the Nile River. So that's a very, it's a, I think what we could easily describe it as is a powder keg, where there is rampant inflation. They've just floated the currency. The government bond yield is around 22%. Inflation is running around 20%. So very mild positive real interest rates. And an acute sensitivity to geopolitical events, because Egypt is one of the largest food importers in the world, and I think the biggest importer of wheat. And then the war in Russia and Ukraine has put particular pressure on the economy. And then we can think about Saudi Arabia. So Saudi Arabia has not got the biggest population, and it does have incredible mineral wealth. But because of the size of the population, where we are somewhere in the region of about 20 million right now, and I don't see it on this list, but I certainly know that it's more than the UAE's 9 million. So perhaps I missed it. So when, there we go, Saudi Arabia, 33 million 5 years ago, probably quite a bit higher than that right now. And huge social change going on right now. And the trajectory of governance is certainly improving. Now, is the standard of governance the same as what one would expect to see in other developed countries? I think that's a bit of a reach. But has the standard of governance improved over the last 5 years? And I think that that is absolutely the case. And there are some incredible changes going on in terms of financial governance. Because what Saudi Arabia, they've basically realized. I had a very interesting meeting with the CEO of the anticipated mining exchange, which will be sponsored by Ajlan Brothers in Saudi Arabia. They want to create a small cap board in Saudi Arabia. Now, the way that stock markets are set up in the region is that you have to have strong profits before you can list on the stock market. And the basic business model of an explorer or a venture index is that they're selling options. That if it goes right, you could make multiples. You can make 10, you can make 20 times your money by investing in a prospective piece of land. Excuse me. And sorry, I need to cough. The other side of that is, if you don't find anything on under that prospective piece of land, then you lose all your money. Which basically means that you can't have a venture index in anywhere in the Middle East, because those same kinds of rules apply in Egypt's stock market. So what from a foreign investor's perspective, you can have reasonable security that when you're buying into an index like the Tadawul or the Hermes index in in Egypt that you're buying profitable companies. And when we think about the Egyptian stock market, well, then you've got big cement companies, and you've got big industrials, you've got big hotel groups, and the share, and this is in pounds, and if I redenominate it into dollars, then the price is exceptionally volatile, and there's a clear downward bias to trading over the course of the last decade, and it is still going down. There will, of course, be some people that will look at the decline in the currency and conclude that this is a buying opportunity. And if the government in Cairo can be forced by the IMF to make enduring reforms, then it could very well be a buying opportunity. And with interest rates that are really rather aggressive, then that's also likely to at least help to stem the really quite profound deterioration in the economy. When we look at the Egyptian T-bills, there is a huge bid-ask spread. So that is also telling you that it's not an especially liquid market. Now, of course, a lot of the domestic people would be buying CDs. Then let's think about the Saudi Arabian market. Now, of course, it's obviously going to be heavily influenced by the outlook for the energy sector. But oil prices are bouncing, and therefore so is the tadawul. And it is peppered with large companies, and particularly those with strong profits. And of course, since the listing of Aramco, then that is the one would think that it would be the largest constituent, but actually Al Rajhi Bank is. But then you also have banks, and you've got SABIC and telecom companies. So these would be considered the big profitable companies within the economy. But the thing that has come out and was something that I learned from a young man who was working at SABIC. He was we were just sitting at during one of the breaks, and he was regaling us with some stories. But perhaps the most important was that the government is now taking the brighter people from the private sector and employing them in ministries. And they're getting a significant pay bump for doing that. And in order for them to take those jobs, well, obviously lots of people want to get a doubling in their salary. But the enthusiasm that young people have now that they could go work at the ministry, they could help to shape policy, and then they have a great deal of confidence in the reforms that have been imposed since 2016 in terms of governance, that it's no longer about the degrees of separation from central power. Of course, there's always going to be degrees of separation from the most powerful people in any country, and there will be peddling of influence regardless of what country you're talking about. But there's also a little cottage industry developing in terms of calling out powerful people for not doing their jobs correctly. And there's a trend of accountability in public office that is truly admirable. And we see lots of different examples of senior people who did not meet the demands that are being put upon them and then get fired. And this is where the creation of a venture index is going to be particularly interesting, because what Laman Rudin was telling me is that from the data that they have, there are about 6 million commodity investors in Saudi Arabia, but you can't deal in commodities inside Saudi Arabia, which means that they're all investing somewhere else. So the regulator doesn't understand that there are things called options, and tend to be exceptionally conservative. So they are not in a hurry to have a venture index where there's the possibility that an investor might actually lose all their money. So that's obviously something that is a how I think probably the best way to say it is that it's an obstacle to setting up a venture exchange. But then you have the pressure that ministers are being put under. And they're being told, you have to get your act together. We need this. We need to create a capital market because we've got a population of give or take 30 million people, and we need to find jobs for about 300 people, 300,000 people a year. So that's you've got a kind of a push and a pull, and you've got the bureaucrats in the middle. And the bureaucrats are being told that they need to start being much more aggressive in terms of developing infrastructure and institutional infrastructure to get these kinds of deals done. And I find that to be really exceptionally enthusiastic. I also know that they're going to start raising funds for early stage investors in that commodities exchange, probably towards the second half of this year, with the strong likelihood that by the time we get to the next one of these strategic mineral forums next year, that they'll be announcing the beginning of that commodities exchange. And then they're going to have London in their sights. Because the primary place where African mines go to list today is on the AIM market. And AIM is bouncing, having halved and more than halved since 2021. That's a higher reaction low. It has now broken the sequence of lower rally highs. So the AIM 100 has significant scope to recover. But the bigger challenge going forward is for competition. And the UK is going to have to work especially hard to become a very favorable destination to list and raise capital. And Saudi Arabia has the capital. What they don't have is the infrastructure of lawyers, insurance companies, and other institutional type of infrastructure, but they can buy that in. And that is apparently what is underway. So I think that's a really significant development. And I do think that as the dollar comes down, then we are going to see greater opportunities in other places. And the pound is now bouncing from the 120 area. Now, when I saw that breakdown earlier on this year through the 120 area and the decline below 110, I was of the opinion that 120 would be an area of resistance for the pound. That has not proved to be the case. And now, in fact, it is looking to be an area of support. And that does look like there is the scope now for a failed downside break. If that is indeed the case, well, it wouldn't be beyond the bounds possibility that we see the pound push back up towards the 140 area. And that would be a very meaningful appreciation. And I think that with the right policies and the right suite of policies, the UK could be in a very favorable position because valuations are low. Sentiment towards potential for growth in the UK is really at a very low ebb, but there is a very significant pool of know-how and talent within the UK economy, within the City of London. And what they need is the regulatory government support in order to really make the best of those resources. And if that is indeed what they can do, well, then they do have a potential to compete. But it's not like there won't be competition. There certainly will be competition, And Saudi Arabia certainly wants to become more of a regional financial market player. And the one of the things that I thought was especially interesting is people, more than one young person told me that what Mohammed bin Salman had said was that instead of going to Disneyland, why not have Disneyland at home? And there was a rave for 700,000 people in the desert in for New Year's Eve this year. And those young people were cavorting in a way that would have been inconceivable 10 years ago. Then, when you think about this, the perception about Saudi Arabia, where there was, I remember when I started out in the financial markets, the area was written off as an intellectual dead zone, that there was huge numbers of graduates were coming out of seminaries and spent their entire lives in religious studies, and there was no appetite for any kind of commercial activity. And it could not be further from the reality today, where you have just large numbers of young people who have been educated in business-oriented degrees and are hungry for opportunity. Now, I also had just some really interesting discussions, and Bill Brody is no longer the CEO of Alien Metals, and he has basically given up that given up the leadership of the company, really with only about 6 months to go before they go into production. So the share price has come down a lot. And then we had that big run up in 2020, and then it gave up the majority. But now it is starting to steady once more. And the price is at a half a p. So we're not talking about a very expensive stock. And it's only got a market cap of 31 million right now. But the resource is there. The resource is shallow, and they have the potential that they're going to start producing at some point in 2023. So iron ore prices have bottomed, and with China starting to open up again and doing whatever they can to boost growth, and they know what their demographic challenges are. And they need to do whatever is necessary to ensure that growth is reasonably steady. And now that Xi Jinping has established himself as leader for life, they felt confident that they could abandon the COVID zero policies. So that's basically what they've done. That's helping to boost demand for commodities. So smaller iron ore producers and are more likely to offer some kind of leverage. And of course, within the sector, I also had I think a rather educative discussion with the executive general manager of Geodrill. And the number one thing that they had to say was that they've got more business than they can actually do. So the share price is now in the region of the all-time peak, and had popped up out of its or come up to test the upper side of its range over the course of the last year. I must go back and look at Alien Metals because my chart was US dollar denominated, so I need to move that back into local currencies, and doesn't change a lot, and the share price is still very clear. But Geodrill is an interesting little company because from their own perspective, they are undervalued, and with a PE of 5.9 and yielding 2%, I think they have reasonable grounds for that kind of conclusion. But the fact that they are exceptionally busy and they're very busy all over Africa, they believe that their valuation is lower because they're in Africa. And the reality is that a lot of the resources that the world needs are going to come out of Africa. So that's not something that's likely to change anytime soon. Now, one thing that I also had, I think, or one of the other big takeaways that I had from this conference was I had a nice conversation with the co-founder and the chief technical officer of a company called Offworld. And there was a lot of technological prospecting companies at this forum. And Offworld is a California company, and they've got basically mining drones. And their whole pitch is around the fact that a lot of the cost of drilling, or the, excuse me, the cost of mining and developing a new mine is really attached to creating a an environment where humans can survive. And their whole pitch is that they have drones that can drill and chisel and cut, and that those battery packs are just lithium-ion battery packs and can last for 6 or 7 hours, and they have other drones that can go down and swap them out, and then the withdrawal of material is also automated. So then their pitch is that by deploying this kind of technological strategy, then they are in a position to reduce mining costs because there won't be quite the need for the miner. Of course, if you have to send somebody down the hole, well, then obviously then you're going to have to need some kind of support systems. And particularly in terms of gas, it's not only about creating an oxygen-rich environment for people to breathe, but also you need to manage the buildup of methane. And obviously, the potential for fire underground is not beneficial for anyone. So I don't quite buy the kind of sales pitch that they're giving, that they're going to massively reduce the cost of developing a mine. But what I have seen around the place are little robots in restaurants that I've talked to a couple of the waitresses. They said that they really are helpful, that it means that when they're clearing tables, they don't have to walk back and forth to the kitchen, but rather that they can just clear the table, put it all on the robot, and the robot will bring it to the kitchen. So it saves them time. And perhaps those kinds of drones will be more at the mine face and will do more of that work. There'll be obviously support staff. I think instead of reducing the cost of developing mines, perhaps there is the potential that it could reduce the number of miners. And if we get a reduced cost of mining eventually, then the number of mines would increase. And of course, that's beneficial for drilling companies. So drilling companies could be the net beneficiary of automation, which is certainly something that I find rather interesting. Now, you also have, or I was chatting to the one of the partners at Aurora Minerals as well. So, Aurora Minerals is a Kazakhstan company. So, and this is not it. Maybe it's not even on Bloomberg, but they're a Kazakhstan company. And what they're basically doing is creating a mine in a box. So they're providing a one-stop service to anyone who wants to speculate on building a mine in Kazakhstan. Then they basically spec out the various projects, get them up to a stage where drilling can start, and then they sell them on. So they said that they're exceptionally busy. And at these kinds of conferences, you're always going to find someone who has a resource that they're raising money to try and develop further. And I thought it was interesting talking with the CEO of Kuya Silver. So the share price is down from 3 to 41 cents. And there's a good reason for that, because they need about 24 million to get into production. And the market cap is 22.4 million. So they're looking for about 4 million. And if they can get that, they can build their processing facility and they can go into production. If they get 20 million, then they are going to be able to ramp up production. And then they have at least 8 million ounces that they can bring to market. And they estimate they have an extra 50 million that also can be brought to market. But at the moment, they are revenue raising. And that means that the potential for dilution in the share is significant because it could dilute by half. So then they are looking for capital investments, and the silver is there, and they're basically mine ready. So all they need is the money to get started. But the willingness of investors to move into a predominantly silver mine is obviously going to be very much tied to the outlook for the silver price. And silver is back in the $25 area. One thing I think is especially important is the underlying base formation. And the price ranged below 20 from 2014 until 2020, and we got a big breakout. And even though the price pulled back below 20, it did not pull down through the middle of the range and then subsequently has rebounded. Now, I think anyone can see that there is still a sequence of lower rally highs, but it is more likely than not that silver will pop on the upside. And when it pops on the upside, it's not going to take too long and before those peaks around $50 are taken out. So then these small mines that have got shovel-ready kind of projects, well, they're having difficulty raising the money today because interest rates have gone up. And investors are worried about dilution, and silver hasn't really been breaking on the upside. But when silver does break on the upside, then those smaller types of companies are going to become more attractive. And then I also had the pleasure of talking with Dan Major, who's the CEO of GovEx. And this, I think, comes to or brings me to a broader discussion of energy overall. So uranium is, I think, from my perspective, an absolute no-brainer. And I was reminded of Donald Cox's "Those Who Love It Best Love It Least," because because they've been disappointed the most. Not when I spoke with the CEO of GovEx, but rather when I spoke with the CEO of Green Lithium in the UK. So, Sean Sargent is the CEO of that company, and they are raising money to build a lithium refinery in the UK on Teesside. And they want to tap into the educated workforce in the region, and particularly the people that used to work in the steel sector. They have the Deepwater Port, and they estimate that they're going to be profitable at a price around $25,000 per ton for lithium. So, obviously, prices have gone up a lot, and Then producing lithium with a low carbon footprint, that's going to tick a lot of boxes for Europe. And I don't think these measures for or everything that's gone into carbon pricing and the protectionist kinds of policies that Europe is deploying right now and forcing anyone who wants to export into Europe to comply with their carbon rules. So that's obviously part of the business model to try and create lithium with as low a carbon footprint as possible so that it will be easy to export into the European Union. And then there's, of course, the next question. Well, what did he used to do? And that was the second part of our conversation, because he used to be in the uranium sector, but not in the mining sector. He worked in nuclear power plants, and he basically lost hope that they would ever be able to build them quickly. And he was somewhat dismissive of small modular reactors because he said they weren't efficient enough. That the big plants are very efficient, small modular reactors are less efficient. But if they can be built quickly, then perhaps then that won't be nearly as problematic. And I personally think that you simply cannot get to a zero carbon energy environment without uranium. So then there is an additional question, there's an additional point. And one of the bullish forecasts, or I guess one of the bullish considerations for anyone who's looking at uranium, well, then it's a big question about, will the EU sanction Rosatom? Because when we think about the uranium sector generally, well, the price is steadying now from the $20 area, and the Global X uranium ETF has been ranging in what I can consider a first step above the base. It's certainly been steadying from the region of the 1,000-day moving average, and it's at a fraction of where it was back in 2010 and 11. I just don't see how it's possible to get to a future of carbon-free energy without nuclear energy. And then let's think about Australia and Fortescue Metals. Got to talk to one of the panelists who was championing the green sector, particularly hydrogen. And Andrew Forrest has locked down some of the intellectual property around the reforming of hydrogen to in a more efficient manner, and I suspect that is a good part of the reason why he's trying to champion hydrogen. But there's a huge amount of work that needs to get done in terms of that hydrogen market. You don't just need productive capacity. You need port facilities. You need transportation facilities, and then you need reforming at the destination. And the transportation, at least, is solved because it will be part of the ammonia cycle. But Fortescue Metals is bouncing because the iron ore price has turned the corner with China reopening. But the big news in Australia in the renewable energy sector this week was that their solar cable company went bust. And that was the big hope for exporting solar energy. And it was going to be a several thousand mile cable running from solar facilities to provide electricity to Singapore from Australia. And the company went bust. There was a similar project that was proposed for the UK, that they would have solar arrays in Morocco and then pipe that solar energy back to the UK. The challenge with these kinds of projects is that they're really rather expensive, and then you are very dependent on the integrity of that cable. And if anything, we know that cables can be sabotaged and pipelines can be sabotaged with very little blowback because it's very hard to prove who did it. And we certainly saw that with the Nord Stream pipeline. So when we think about these ambitious renewable energy plans, it's, I think, very difficult to get them built. Then also the just the basic proof case is less convincing when nuclear energy is an established zero carbon solution. So I just can't see how that's not going to be part of the future. Now, something that I'm also very aware of, I watched The Big Short for the first time on the plane home, and the thing that I think is most important, or just from the perspective of someone who works in the financial industry, there's a great pressure on people to come up with very aggressive targets. And I've certainly been bearish of the cloud computing sector for the last year, and it's just beginning to find short-term support, but it's still in a downtrend overall. And after the pandemic and the surprise of the war in Ukraine, then investors are under a great deal of pressure to think about non-linear conclusions. And obviously, as we are still in a very tight liquidity environment, and I'm very much of the opinion that a recession in the USA is inevitable, then it does lend itself to making bold predictions. But that we also have to be aware of the fact that at the moment there is a bit of a competition going on for the most bearish forecast. So, Dr. Doom, what's his name? The Italian economist has just written a new book. And then we have several geopolitical strategists writing exceptionally dreary predictions for the future. So let's just try and think about it from first principles. The first thing is, and that's why I started off this broadcast thinking about demographics. China has deteriorating demographics, and that is going to put even greater pressure on the governance sector. They're going to have to clamp down on corruption, and relying on vanity projects isn't going to be something that will easily be achieved, or will achieve the goals of global domination, which are very clearly stated. India has a large young population, and they have to deploy the kinds of improving standards of governance necessary to employ large numbers of people. Then, something that I thought was also very interesting, that I really enjoy speaking with the CEO of Perseus Mining. He's a very Geoffrey Quartermaine's a very erudite speaker, and he's got a lot of experience mining in Africa, particularly in Ghana, Cote d'Ivoire, and now in Sudan. I was in Sudan 20 years ago. It's got some of the best diving in the Red Sea, and the share price is around 10.6. Last year, he was talking about the difficulties they have with the artisanal miners in Ghana and trying to enforce a claim and dealing with the local community. And of course, Ghana is another country with a large young population and high population density, And then on top of that, had a run in with a sovereign default this year. So this year, I was also speaking with some indigenous communities in from Ghana, and basically what they're doing is the tribes are getting together. And they're trying to attract inward investment directly into their local community and basically trying to circumvent the government. And this is a sign of just how difficult the economic environment in Ghana is right now. And it's obviously problematic. And it's also why Perseus decided that they were going to invest in the Nubian Shield in Nubia, which is Sudan. That was also the one of the big topics of conversation in the forum last year, that it was developing the super region and the Nubian Shield, which stretches the whole way across North Africa and into the Middle East as a major mining destination. And they find that they have better and easier buy-in from the government in Sudan, in support of their mining operation, because they have first mover advantage, and the government wants the management of Perseus to go out and preach about Sudan as a new mining destination. And they've been very clear, and they've stated in plain English that if we can't make a success of it here, then it's going to be very hard for anyone to come here. So they're very much in partnership with the local government. And it also then helps to highlight that governance doesn't necessarily have to be about democracy, but d governance is about improving standards and being able to enforce your claim and your title. And then having recourse to an arbitration and or at least the courts, and then ultimately having a free and independent press. Now, certainly Sudan doesn't have all those things, but when we think about it as a relative consideration, I remember when I was in Sudan 20 years ago, in order to fly out of Port Sudan, everybody had to go through a full hands-on body check, and you're just stripped down to your underwear, and then the plane flying in was escorted by fighter jets. So it was a very visceral experience to go through the airport in Port Sudan. And certainly now, after the civil war with South Sudan, with the loss of their oil production because of that independence movement in South Sudan, Sudan itself has to come up with solutions. And mining, and the fact that Sudan is one of the top five producers of gold in the world without having a major mine. That the level of artisanal activity is absolutely profound. So the government doesn't actually get any benefit out of that, and that's obviously something that they're looking to change. So I really think that there are significant opportunities in the region. And then let's think about the outlook for Mexico. So, Mexico has a population in excess of 100 million. But more important than that, the Darien Gap is open. And I think it might be more correct to say that the Darien Gap is wide open. And that, I think, is something that is brand new. So, for years, there was no road that went through Panama into South America. And You didn't have more than a handful of people making what was an exceptionally treacherous journey around that area. But now it's a well-trodden path. And quarter of a million people walked from South America into Central America last year. So when we think about the mass migration and the literally 2 million people who walked over the US border last year, this isn't something that's going to change. The entire Latin American continent has the potential to walk north. And this is obviously going to create difficulties in terms of immigration policy. But it also means that there is going to be a vast young population looking for economic opportunities. And there's a strong likelihood that many of them will find those opportunities in Mexico. And working in factories exporting into the North American market. So the vast majority of people that are migrating into the USA right now are not Mexican. They are largely from El Salvador, Guatemala, and Venezuela. And I think this is something that's going to persist. There's going to be a lot of migration into Mexico. And in terms of the nearshoring trend, it just makes sense to have more manufacturing closer to a geopolitical stable area rather than relying on trans-Pacific transportation. So then let's think about shipping overall, because shipping prices have come down in a very profound manner and unwound are completely unwound the big run-up that we had in 2021. And this is really quite similar to the spikes we've had in the past. And then prices have come all the way back down into the lower side of the range. Now let's think about the same thing for oil tankers. This is the Dirty Tanker Index. And it surged up to $2,500. And then in the space of 5 weeks, I gave up almost half. And we have to go all the way back to the global financial crisis period for any time that prices got up to 2,500. And then they were very choppy. So we had a high seasonality. And there's the possibility that that's what we're looking at right now, that we could be looking at high seasonality in terms of the Baltic Dry Index, with oil prices starting to push back up. Then Ardmore Shipping, for example, is still locked in this consolidation overall. And when we think about the outperformance of the UK market and the BlackRock World Mining Trust pushing up to test the peak from 2022, I think it's really exceptionally important to put these longer-term trends in the context of tightening global liquidity. So the 10-year minus the 2-year yield curve spread is still at a negative 72 basis points. And the 10-year minus the 3-month is now at a negative 100 basis point level. So there are three phases to an inverted yield curve. We're currently in the second one, which is that we're still inverting. So liquidity conditions continue to tighten. And we are in that happy stage where liquidity conditions are tightening and have not yet shown up in the broad economy. But they will. And that will take us to the third stage. And it's when unemployment starts to rise. Then that's when we're going to have much more pressure on central banks to cut interest rates. And that's usually coinciding with an earnings recession. Now, as we look at the near term, we have the potential for further upside because China's growth is picking up, and the market is looking through the current tightening environment to when the central bank will be cutting interest rates. But financial conditions have been easing up because of the rebound in the bond market, the rebound in equities, and oil prices continue to hold around the 80 level. Natural gas was very weak for the last month and is now back in the region of the lows. Now, I bought some before I went to Saudi Arabia. I'm currently underwater on it, and I will see what happens on Monday, but I'm certainly not going to burn for the faith with this long position. I think that there is still scope for the Nasdaq to rally further and certainly to at least test the region of the 200-day moving average. That would take it up to about 12,000 and change. But the commodity sector doing so well in an environment where we have an inverted yield curve, that's very late stage activity. And the very strong outperformance on a relative basis, at least, of the dividend aristocrats, and more recently, in terms of absolute performance, that's also rather late stage as well. Now, as we think about the dollar, there's obviously the very clear potential that the dollar is or has peaked on at least a short term and maybe a medium term basis. And there is a lot of debt that needs to be printed this year. And the Federal Reserve is not buying it. So someone else is going to have to buy it. That tells me at least that we definitely have downward pressure on yields at present. And a good part of the reason for that is because of quantitative tightening. But eventually, someone is going to have to buy all that additional debt that the federal government is going to be borrowing this year. And that suggests that quantitative easing will have to kick up again. And then we might get yields falling in the beginning of the year, but rising towards the end of the year. And I still think that there's a recession coming. But the demographic trends are certainly pointing towards a strong performance over the long term for India, Indonesia, Malaysia, potentially Nigeria, Saudi Arabia, and countries that have the ability to deploy strong governance to harness economic potential will be those that clearly outperform over the long term. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.